I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. This hour will teach you the best ways to keep your brain sharp as you get older. And I guess everybody listening is a little bit older today than you were yesterday. We're going to talk about busyness. Scientists have previously said that if you engage in mentally challenging activities, it can help keep your brain sharp. There's a new study now, a survey of over 300 people, the Dallas Lifespan Brain Study, and the authors of the study, two of whom are with us this hour, suggest that if you keep a busy schedule, you may find benefits as you get older. They have done this study of people ranging in age from 50 to 89 years old, and there was a positive effect of busyness on brain, and it's consistent across age. So it's important to be busy when you're in middle age as well as in old age. What do we mean by busyness? Are there certain kinds of busy activities that make your brain stronger than others? We have two guests with us this hour. Denise Park is Director of Research at the Center for Vital Longevity, Distinguished University Chair in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, and Regents Research Scholar at the University of Texas in Dallas. Her primary research is on understanding the neural mechanisms that account for age-related cognitive decline. Sarah Festini is also with us, a postdoc research associate at the Center for Vital Longevity, and she is also a fellow of the Aging Mind Foundation. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have quite a few because we're all interested in how to keep the mind sharp as we grow older. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where if you like us, you'll get little announcements of events that we have coming up day by day. So it's a good thing to do, plus pictures of beautiful dogs. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Denise Park, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Sarah Festini, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here, too.
So what do we mean by busyness, Professor Bark?
Well, what we mean by busyness is how engaged you are in a range of activities, how full your life is, and also the busyness questionnaire we used also talked about how predictable your life is. Do you go to bed at the same time? Do you go to bed at unusual and different hours every day? Do you have a routine? So it's one, how full is your life? How many activities fill it up? How often do you have time to do things, or versus how often do you feel you have more to do than you can possibly accomplish?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know you studied how predictable life is. Do you find that most people do have a routine? They get up at the same time, eat the same breakfast, go to bed at the same time, or do we mix it up as we grow older?
I think we found that people who are older lead more routine lives than people who are younger, that you get more routinized with age.
Do you sleep as much when you get old? I've heard that you don't. Is that true?
People who are old, as we age, we tend to have more interrupted sleep and sleep somewhat fewer hours. That mm-hmm. is correct.
Hmm. Well, that gives you more time to be busy during the day, right?
It does indeed.
Yeah. Sarah, by busyness, I know you looked at certain kinds of activities that might be better while you're busy than others. You had people do certain kinds of tasks, learn new things. Is that right?
Right. So we had people come into the lab and do a series of tasks on the computer or with paper and pencil. And we measured things like memory, so how well people learned lists of words, how well they processed new incoming information, how well they reasoned, and also looked at things like vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. And then you had them do a certain, were they doing quilting or knitting or something like that as well?
For this study that looked at the relationship with busyness and cognitive performance, we did not have people engage in these other types of tasks. But Denise has done some prior work that looked at training older adults with quilting or digital photography, and she found that after this extended training with this new learning, the older adults that did this new learning had better memory after 3 months.
Hmm. Do you want to talk more about that, Denise?
Oh, sure. So sort of a prelude to the work on the Dallas Lifespan Brain Study where we measured busyness. We looked at the effects of engagement in mentally challenging activities. And the idea behind that is the following. Everybody thinks that the more you engage in new learning and so forth, the better your mind is, or staying active and doing things improves your cognition. But the truth is we really don't know that. It's very hard to do a study where you actively assign people to being deeply engaged in a change in lifestyle versus doing more passive things. But we developed a paradigm or a project where I rented a space and called it the synapse environment and created a learning environment for older adults in a strip mall. And basically, people had to agree to be randomly assigned to different groups. So they had to agree to be in a range of different conditions. And here's what we asked them to do. We asked one group was assigned to learn quilting, another group to learn digital photography using Photoshop. It was not; these were very challenging conditions. Mm-hmm. A third group learned both. And then we had a group that just had fun and didn't learn very much. And just did entertaining things, and then a group that worked quietly at home on some sort of low-level test that probably wouldn't improve your cognition. And they were they did this for 3 months, 15 hours a week. And before they entered the study, we measured their cognitive function, and we measured it again afterward the 3 months, and we measured it a year later. Go ahead.
No, please, you go ahead.
And we basically found that the people who were in the mentally challenging conditions, digital photography, quilting, or a combination of the two, had better memory function at the end of the study, had improved their memory function relative to the two control groups that either just had fun for the same number of hours per week or worked at home on low-challenge tasks. So what was important about this study is it's an experiment. It's not just a correlation where you just see that, people who are engaged do better. Well, maybe they do better because they're healthier or they're smarter or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real experimental test of does being busy affect your cognition or improve it? And it turns out it does. But in this case, mental challenge really made the difference.
Interesting. And is it true, I think it's commonly held belief that our minds are most pliable when we're very, very young. So the first few years of life, you can learn things effortlessly, and that maybe you can't learn how to quilt when you're 70 years old. Can you?
Yes, you can. Actually, people made amazingly beautiful items and pieces of handiwork. People learned how to do Photoshop. They learned how to do all kinds of special effects. And one woman said to me, it was one of the most insightful things anybody said to me later, she said, you know, I didn't like quilting very much, but what I learned is that I can learn new things.
Mm.
And as a result, she started taking other courses, and really, it really changed her life. And it changed many people's lives, I think, as a result of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's encouraging. When you talk about busyness, having a packed schedule, how do you describe that? Is that so many hours a day of doing one thing after another, and you have to do so many things? Is it 8 hours? What does it mean to be busy?
Right. So for our study, we had participants complete a questionnaire where we asked them to think about things like how often they had too many tasks to complete in a day, or how often they went to bed later than their typical bedtime because they had too many things to do. So there's a series of 7 questions that people had to rate and indicate basically how often they had a lot of stuff going on in their lives. And then we calculated an average score to this questionnaire to determine an average busyness level for that individual.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think of it as a measure of environmental press. Like, how often are you in an environment, or is your environment too full, or you feel like you have so much to do that you can barely accomplish it all? That's sort of the signature of a busy person. And we did some earlier work a number of years ago where we were studying how people what caused people to remember to take their medications or to forget them. And we found that this busyness scale, out of all the different measures we took, was the best predictor of not remembering to take your meds, that people who were extremely busy or who reported being extremely busy were less likely to be accurate in their use of their medications. It was actually the middle-aged people, not the older people, who made the biggest number of mistakes in taking their meds.
Well, that's not good, is it?
No. But middle-aged people also tend to be the busiest people, do you see?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's also common wisdom, I think, and many have experienced this, that if you are a busy person, you may forget to take your meds, but you may be under a lot of stress, too. Your bedtime is later, you can't get things done, you get worked up about it, you can't sleep, etc. Isn't that true or not?
Yes, it's definitely possible that busier people could be more stressed. So one thing that our study did not measure, though, was measures of stress within the same individual. So we weren't able to look at the relationship between busyness levels and stress levels within the same person. But what our results are suggesting, so we found that people that reported greater levels of busyness tended to have better mental function than less busy people, which is consistent with this engagement idea, that if you're more engaged and you have a more active life, that was related to better mental function, which is not what you would expect if busyness was really increasing your level of stress.
Yeah, one thing we were surprised about, Kathleen, was we did consider that busyness could actually harm your cognition, because there's good evidence from Robert Sapolsky's work at Stanford that individuals that are very stressed dump a hormone, cortisol, into their brain, and it serves a short-term purpose in that it activates you and makes you perform more effectively when you're under stress. We've all had that experience.
Sure.
But over the long term, cortisol damages your brain. It damages your hippocampus. And so we were considering that busy people might perform more poorly cognitively on these cognitive tasks, and they actually perform better. The other thing that Sarah's looking at is we haven't completed these analyses yet, but we actually have brain images, brain scans of all of these individuals, and we're looking to see at the different structures in the brain. Are they larger or smaller as a result of being busy?
And you're looking at that now?
Yes.
And when you talk about determining the mental function of somebody, how do you determine that? You ask questions, you have them do tasks, or what?
Right. So they come into the lab, and we give them a series of standardized tasks that measure things like memory. So when we give memory tests, a lot of these involve reading them lists of words or showing them a list of words, and then waiting a delay, and then asking them to recall the words that they studied before. So that's an example of a memory task. We can also give them reasoning tests where they have to figure out a pattern to complete a set that we show them.
Mm-hmm.
And we measure things like vocabulary, which is just general knowledge that people have. But basically, we have a series of these tasks for each of the different cognitive domains, and we can create an average score for each of those tasks to see generally how good someone's memory is or how good their vocabulary is, for instance.
And in all of those areas, busyness helped people perform better, or some areas better than others?
Right. So we found significant positive associations for all of the measures. So
all of them.
Right. So greater busyness was associated with better episodic memory, better working memory, better processing speed, better reasoning, and also better vocabulary. But the strongest relationship that we observed was for episodic memory, or just memory, what you typically think of as memory.
Mm-hmm. And did it make a difference? I don't know if this was part of the study, if all of these activities were done with other people, where you were interacting verbally with people as well, or could you just be by yourself making a quilt and then doing something else that was good for your mind after that and be by yourself for a good portion of the day?
We didn't really address that issue. Think of the busyness questionnaire as sort of a lifestyle questionnaire in the sense that is your life full of busy events? Are you in a chronic state of being highly obligated? We didn't look at the state of busyness. Like if you're busy at this moment, what's the effect on cognition? Probably you would expect that if at any given moment that you're very busy, it's going to have a negative effect on your cognition at the moment because you're going to be distracted by what you're doing. But in terms of leading a full, busy lifestyle, that seemed to be very supportive of cognitive enhancement across the lifespan. Mm.
Well, let's welcome phone calls. Questions from our audience or people who will attest to being older or middle-aged and being busy or knowing people in your family who are busy or not busy. But this study is an interesting one, investigation of whether busyness was beneficial or detrimental to cognition in adults 50 to 89 years of age. Our guests are Denise Park. She is director of research at the Center for Vital Longevity and distinguished university chair in behavioral and brain sciences at the University of Texas in Dallas. Sarah Festini is a postdoc research associate at the center, and we're welcoming phone calls from you and other ways you can get a hold of us. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, two phone calls. Let's start with Heather in Somerset. Hi, Heather.
Hello. How are you ladies today?
Fine.
Great.
Everybody's good.
Good deal. Today is my day off. I started at 8:30 this morning, and my day has consisted of my ETA on my MapQuest being the time to beat. I've gone from River Falls to Chippewa Falls to Eau Claire to Chippewa Falls, all Somerset, on my way to Osceola, and I will be rolling into home maybe about 7:30 this evening, and that's my day off.
Wow. What are you doing all day, Heather?
What am I doing all day?
Right.
I have doctor's appointments for a special needs child, going to look at a group home for my daughter, an appointment for me, training at work. And then I work 12-hour night shifts three nights a week, plus pick up overtime when I can.
This is a busy person, Denise.
It sounds like we have a very busy woman here, yes.
Yeah. So that's good for her?
Well, is that your question, Heather? Is it good for you?
Heather? I guess she's running off to her next place. Yeah. Is it good for her?
It's probably good for her. I mean, our data would suggest that it is. And honestly, we were somewhat surprised by our findings because, as my mother said, I'm always running around like a chicken without my head or with my head cut off kind of thing. And
right.
She seemed to think running around all the time wasn't good for me. But it seems like being a very busy person has more of an upside than a downside. I won't say it never has a downside. This is group data. It doesn't speak to any one individual. But in general, it appears that being busy is correlated quite strongly with good cognitive function. Now, one caveat about that is possible, again, we want to mention that very high ability people may be very busy, and that could be driving the correlation, but that's why we did something like the Synapse Project I talked about earlier, mm-hmm. where we did a real experiment, and it turned out that people who were experimentally exposed to being busy and engaging in mental challenge actually did show an improvement in cognition. So we tend to think it really is that busyness enhances neural circuitry and improves cognition.
Thanks, Heather, so much for your call. Claire in Madison, in Milwaukee. Hi, Claire.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for the program. Well, my age and my mother's age fall into the category that you studied. I'm 50, she's 87. I think her memory's better than mine. I've been a full-time caregiver for her, and I mean full-time, along with my sister, for a number of years. I've been at a very long time, 20 years for both my parents, and now 10 years for mom. But, Yeah, I'm to the point where, I mean, I'm way beyond burnout, you know. And so my I run between two households, and my hours are totally mixed up. I go to bed in the wee hours of the morning, usually after falling asleep on the couch for a few hours, maybe catch an hour or two actually in bed and get up and do it all over again. Mm. And I have 12 to 15-hour days. And, yeah, what I'm finding is my cognitive behavior is all over the place. Some days I'm really clear and I can really... Oh, like I spent 6 hours in the ER with her over the weekend, and I just boom, boom, boom. I can rattle off all the health history to the doctors and nurses and speak intelligently. And then, you know, I come home and I, you know, just forget things or I'm clumsy or whatever. So I can really see, you know, just an up and down pattern with my cognitive ability, that's for sure.
And how about your health? You're not sleeping enough.
Well, I actually, sometimes I fit in, you know, maybe 5-6, some days a little bit more, just depending upon, but I'm still holding my own, doing okay so far. Yeah, but you know, what can you do? You have to do what you have to do, and people say this to me, and I say, how am I different than a single mother with three children working at least two jobs?
Mm-hmm.
How is that any different?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so... I do it so Mom doesn't have to go to a nursing home.
Denise.
Well, what I would say is you have two forces operating there, maybe one for the good of your cognitive system and one for not so good. And it's what Kathleen suggested. I think you're not getting enough sleep. And it turns out lack of sleep is quite a pernicious condition, and it can affect your cognition, certainly for the short term. There's no question sleep deprivation negatively affects cognition, and it's starting to look like that even sustained long-term sleep deprivation over time can negatively influence cognition. So, and it may be that you're doing a lot of things, but a lot of the time it's not clear. You may not be as busy as you think. You may be... you know, just sitting at home waiting for your mother to do various things, and you may be sort of disengaged mentally at times, even though you're physically very active, and that might be different than being cognitively busy. So it's hard to say. But in general, I think keeping a very complex active schedule is probably good for your cognition, but what would be best would be to be active and get enough sleep, and it sounds like you're probably not doing that through no fault of your own, for sure.
And what about doing, I don't know if this correlates to what you've studied, but doing something for herself? She sounds like a wonderful caregiver, but maybe taking up quilting or some other skill would be good for her.
Right, so doing things like exercise and like meditation and self-reflection have also shown benefits to cognitive performance. So taking time for yourself is also good. I think that one thing that is unstudied currently is the relationship between busyness and time for other things like exercise and sleep and how that might relate to stress. So it would be good for future research to measure these things within the same person to see if people that are really busy but maybe not getting enough sleep might have a different pattern with regard to their cognitive performance.
Mm-hmm.
And one last comment here. Caregivers are in a very, very difficult situation. I totally admire their contributions to their family's well-being and welfare. But at the same time, it's very common for caregivers to experience depression because they don't totally have control over their own lives, and it can feel rather hopeless at times. And depression is not good for your brain either. So that's another issue to consider, and doing things for yourself can often alleviate some of that negative affect that goes with constantly being in the service of other people. It's
mm-hmm.
a very difficult situation.
Hmm. Claire, thanks so much for your call. Nate in Mazamani, hi.
Hi, thanks for the program. I just want to give a couple anecdotal responses. First of all, I retired early, about 58, and prior to that, I think I suffered from sleep deprivation because on the average, I think I was probably sleeping about 6.5 hours a night. And I definitely felt that after I retired, my mental acuity improved. Some of it, I think, was probably because I got more sleep. But also, I think I have been continually active with various activities, most of them group involvement. I'll do trainings up to 2 or 3 times a week, or meetings 2 or 3 times a week, plus keeping up with all of my communication by phone, by emails, etc. So I'm very busy 7 days a week on these, engaging in these projects that I, my heart is in. And I think it has improved my mental acuity significantly.
Right. So some of the things that you mentioned doing after you retired involved kind of new learning and picking up new skills and new tasks. And that is consistent with some of the prior work in Dr. Park's lab that showed that this new learning and novelty of learning to quilt or learning digital photography improved memory function in older adults. So I think it's great that you picked up these new activities, and that would be consistent with this evidence suggesting that new learning improves memory.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people who have highly mentally challenging jobs might profit from continuing to work, but lots of people get in a rut in their job and they find that the novelty and the mental challenge comes after they quit their jobs and engage in new learning and new behaviors that they've never had an opportunity to try before. And that almost certainly is likely to be good for your brain and your cognition.
Thanks, Nate. I'm glad things are going well for you. Going back to the earlier study that you did, Dr. Park, when you chose quilting and digital photography, do you have a whole list of new things to learn that are better for the brain than others? Why did you choose those two?
Well, it actually, that's a really interesting question. We considered a lot of things, and we considered things like learning chess or learning bridge, learning a new language, learning to play the piano, learning dance, but we rejected all of those because here were the criteria. We didn't want a situation where people would be competing with one another because we didn't want to mediate quarrels. Second, we wanted something that everybody could learn and everybody could do and that was infinitely complex so that you wouldn't top out at something.
Mm-hmm.
And photography and quilting both are infinitely complex. They're non-competitive. They're social, so there's a lot of social interaction while people were learning. And it's, everybody can do it. So it narrowed itself down pretty quickly. I also, piano and language learning sounded great, except that I was afraid that people would find out they didn't like it and they would drop out of the study. And then that sort of scientifically invalidates your findings if too many people drop out. And we had an 85% compliance rate.
Wow.
It was incredible. And I mean, people would sometimes have to drop out mostly because they either had a transportation issue or a family issue or a health problem on their own. And we had people actually crying because they had to leave the study. They liked it so much. So It turns out people can change their behavior if the change is to do something fun and exciting and engaging. And that's what we tried to do, is change people's lifestyles in a positive direction rather than, say, do cognitive training where they're banging away on a computer.
Let's go to Barbara in Milwaukee next. Hi, Barbara. Barbara, are you there? Barbara's not there. Jacob, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for the guests today. I commute 140 miles per day.
Wow.
I know. And recently, and I'm an avid music lover, but I found that I was very bored driving that long listening to music, which is why I'm listening to public radio today.
Great.
I find it much more engaging. But just in terms of keeping myself engaged, I had considered listening to books on tape. My question for the guest is, would an activity like that, which is not socially engaging, but is certainly mentally engaging, have the same benefits as some of the more hands-on skills that they've discussed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we think that this new learning is really what's critical for the benefit we're seeing with this engagement. So if the books on tape required you to learn new skills or new information, that would probably have a greater likelihood of having a benefit. But doing anything that can keep you more engaged and more active would seem to be the way to go.
One thing I'll say about books on tape is that if you get sort of complex stories or informationally rich books, it requires you to use your imagination and construct the images because you're not seeing anything, and you have to engage your imagination quite a bit. And I actually think, in particular, books on tapes could be very facilitative because they involve a lot of mental activity to construct and imagine the scene, as well as sort of remember what you just heard and keep that in your memory at the same time. So I actually would be very encouraging of books on tape, but I'd make sure that it was rich text, either informationally rich or linguistically complex, such as some of the, you know, the great writers of classic novels and things of that sort involve.
Hmm. Good advice, Jacob.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. And we go next to Joanne in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Joanne.
Hi, yeah, Joanne. Hi. I wanted to comment and ask a question. When I officially retired and stopped being incredibly busy at work, I sort of went into a down period because I wasn't doing anything creative. And then I found some new activities and have met a whole different circle of people. And now I am what one of my friends calls one of the busiest retired people they know. So I guess that's good. And should I continue to be as busy as I am with boards and activities and projects and documentaries and all the things I do? Or should I start backing off before I burn out?
Right. Well, it sounds like it's a good thing. So our research finds that people that reported greater levels of busyness had better cognitive performance than people that reported lower levels of busyness. And it sounds like you're having fun and you're not especially stressed in this particular lifestyle. So I would encourage you to keep living this active life because it seems like it has benefits to cognition.
You agree? Yeah, Dr. Park, you agree?
Absolutely, and I think Sarah hit it just right. I think one of the challenges of retirement for many people is creating a context that drives you and keeps you busy. When you have a job, typically you have to go to work and you have a lot of responsibilities. And I think one of the hardest parts about retirement is there's unless you create something and create a set of obligations, there's nothing that you absolutely have to do, and it can be, I think, very destructive of your mental state and short-term and maybe and long-term probably of your cognitive function if you don't have something driving you. So I think what she has done is exactly the way to go.
Did you feel it was okay, Joanne, though, and maybe good for you to just do nothing for a while?
It was okay for a couple of months. But then I had to start giving myself structure,
right?
And I had to sort of give myself time limits of what I could do. And I also found that when I wasn't doing anything and not interacting with other people like I was used to doing every day, that it was getting very depressing.
Yes.
And I had to get out. Some people say, oh, I can work at home. I am not able to work at home. I have to leave my home to do what I'm going to do and interact with other people and then come back home, and then I can rest. Otherwise, I don't get anything done.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. If I spend, and I've done that too, spend long periods of time by yourself, and it becomes a rather strange world. And I know a lot of people do that and have to, but they shouldn't have to if they don't want to. You can get in a very strange place to just have yourself to deal with, can't you?
Definitely. I agree with that. And just myself, I bore myself, so I got to have other people.
No, Joanne, you shouldn't bore yourself. You're an interesting person. Dr. Park, you were going to say something.
One thing I could sort of share an experience very similar to Joanne's. I had a major operation that was not, well, it was serious, but it's all resolved very nicely.
Good.
But I've been home for about 6 weeks without any structure, and I've been told to rest. And it's not been very much fun, but I was in a high-rise, and there's lots of people coming and going. And I'm, even though I'm home or have been home, I'm back at work now in my office today, it's a very rich context, and I think there's lots of people coming and going, and it seems like I have some kind of salon almost every night in my home. And I've realized that's a really wonderful context, and there's always something to do and someone with an idea or interesting conversation, and it's really made this sort of difficult situation very tolerable. And I really encourage people to think about living in groups, not in group homes or anything like that, but in rich context where they maintain contact with their neighbors and friends, and that they have a very active social life that continues beyond the workplace, because social interactions actually have a fair amount of mental challenge inherent in them. You know, there's lots of challenging questions and interactions, and if you're meeting lots of new people, you have a memory load. You have to remember and think about what they've talked about. If you can't remember things from day to day, that's not very healthy for your relationships. So there is actually a memory load and a cognitive load associated with social interactions that people should not underestimate.
So how did you keep, or how do people keep, when they're forced to be by themselves from, because of sickness or they're recovering from an operation? We all face times in our lives when we are by ourselves. When we're born and when we die, too, but those are different examples. But what did you do, Dr. Park, when you were forced to be at home to keep your mind active? What did you do?
Well, I've never listened to a book on tape in my life before, but I had to lay flat in bed. So I had a spinal surgery.
Oh.
So I started listening to books on tape. I started... I'm sort of a lover of all kinds of reasoning games and word games, and they're very available on all kinds of devices. So I think if I have more than 2 minutes that are unfilled, I start playing a word game that requires the mental acuity.
Mm-hmm.
And spend a lot of time on the computer, and I would dictate my emails to someone, which again requires a lot more mental effort to keep it all together, to write a long, coherent text without being able to see what you're writing. So I think all of those things were very, very stimulating, and it's been okay.
Good. We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Our guests have done a very major and interesting study on busyness that you can keep your brain sharper. And we're talking about, in many, many areas, your memory, your reasoning, your recall, your vocabulary, if you are a busy person. And they studied people ages 50 to 89. We're welcoming phone calls for Dr. Denise Park, Director of Research at the Center for Vital Longevity at the University of Texas, Dallas. Sarah Festini, postdoc research associate at the same center. And here is our number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Joanne, thanks for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Wanda in Rhinelander. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, yes, I just wanted to comment on Jacob. I drive also for a living. I drive all over Wisconsin, and I put on close to 1,500 miles in 4 days.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I listen to music. I've been doing it for 12 years, a lot of music, and then I found WPR. I listen to that quite often. But somebody turned me on to the book on tape thing, and actually it's audible off my phone, and I just love it. I'm thinking about trying to maybe learn a new language.
Yeah. What would you learn? What language?
I don't know. You know, it's just an opportunity. You know, you're sitting in your vehicle for long periods of time to pick that up. And
right.
There's nobody else in my vehicle. I mean, you know what I mean? You can talk loud and, you know, I think it would be a good learning thing.
I think that'd be great, don't you, Dr. Park, to learn a language? You're talking to somebody if you're by yourself in the car?
I think that's a fantastic idea, and I think there's so many different kinds of opportunities and products with all the technology we have to do things that are mentally stimulating. And in fact, we distinguish in our work between what we call productive versus receptive engagement. And receptive engagement is a more passive kind of engagement where, yeah, you're listening to music or you're doing things that are very familiar and are not novel. And productive engagement is when you're actively manipulating information or learning new information. And I think listening to music is great. I mean, I'm not saying it's a great thing, but I would call that receptive engagement. That's going to be less productive for your cognitive system. And learning a new language in your car, what a great idea. I would call that productive engagement, where you're subjecting yourself to a sustained mental challenge. And that would be, we believe that type of engagement is what's really productive for your cognitive system.
All right, Wanda, go do it. Call us back in whatever language you learn. And then we can learn new words as well. Randy is next in Sauk County. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Great discussion. I wonder if your guests could comment. I read a study, as a matter of fact, I went and printed it out from the National Institutes of Health, and I've got the publication number here and everything, that says basically it shows that beyond a shadow of a doubt, they were able to conclude that cognitive demands lower capacities for eating restraint, say, and you had higher levels of obesity, or for restraining the higher cognitive load you had as an individual. If you chose busyness, there was often some kind of a choice going on to not maybe face other maybe more demanding private sort of development issues, because your cognitive load actually lowered your capacity for dealing with those things. And I just wonder, I've got the number of the study here. It was quite well done.
All right, let's get a response.
I think I know what you're talking about. Are you talking about rebound effects, where you control yourself in one domain and you can't control yourself in another?
Well, so, I know at one time I was quite obese, and I went at it, and I had to, you know, 25 years ago, I had to change, or I would have not lived, you know. And so as I studied it and tried to figure out what I was doing wrong, I realized that sort of the here and there, an extreme load of being busy maybe was not helpful for my being able to really have a lifestyle that promoted health.
Hmm. No, I think I know what you're talking about. There's some evidence that you can only put yourself under so much load. And so, for instance, if you spend a lot of focus, say, on cognition, you might not be as well able to, say, control your eating behavior. Or if you control your eating behavior very tightly, you may be more lax in other domains. And it seems like we can only put ourselves under X amount of load across domains, and if you are very tight in one domain, you might be very lax in another. And I think we only have so much resource to, we have a limited amount of resources to manage and control our behaviors. So if you overload in one, you may not have so much control in another.
Thanks for your call, Randy. Tim in Elkhorn, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm basically an introvert, and I don't do well in social groups. I avoid them quite often, although I have a wonderful relationship with a woman, and we do a lot of things. I do a specialized form of physical therapy where I spend an hour and a half with each person, and I did this for years, and that was basically my social life. Mm. When I retired recently, I found I was at sea. And finally, after about 3 months, I started seeing some people in my home again. And now I'm feeling fine, but I'm not really busy. And I'm wondering, you know, what happens to introverts with regard to your guests' you know, studies and affairs.
Right. So introverts can still be busy. Being busy doesn't mean that you have to have a lot of social interactions. It could involve social interactions. But if you're an introvert and you don't enjoy socializing often, you can still engage in a lot of activities and have a lot of commitments and things to do that can maintain a busy lifestyle.
It's because, you know, I find I'm much happier. I see two to four patients a week at my home, and that seems to make me content, and I can go about other things around the house, around the neighborhood, you know, errands that I'm perfectly satisfied with, but maybe not as busy as would be optimal for me at this age.
Well, it might. I think there's two dimensions here. What you want to do is you can be very busy, and it doesn't, as Sarah said, and it doesn't need to involve socializing. I think what you want to do is engage in mental challenge. You could be an introvert, say, and enjoy woodworking and putting together complex things and making new things and challenge yourself in that way. So that's just an example. It's a very introverted behavior, but it's a very mentally challenging one, and your work sounds like it's quite challenging as well. So I don't think you have to be social to be busy. You just have to be engaged in some way and either have a context that drives your behavior, and other people can be driven by their own internal needs and controls. It doesn't have to come from outside. It can come from your own internal wants and needs and pleasures that will keep you busy in various ways.
I wanted to ask you, when you said you're doing brain scanning now, what are you looking at? What kind of scanning are you doing? Are you looking at neurons or something in the brain to see how all of this affects cognition in a real way in the brain?
Well, this is the Dallas Weisman brain study is actually a very complex study, and the busyness piece was just a small part of it. We are scanning people to look at the structure of their brain with an MRI machine. We also look at how their brain functions by giving people cognitive tasks to perform while we're scanning their brain. So we can look at the neural circuitry that and how it differs as a function of age and how it differs as a function of busyness. And then finally, we also do PET scans on about half of our participants to look at deposition of amyloid, a protein associated with Alzheimer's disease.
Oh.
These are all healthy people, but it turns out the very earliest phases of Alzheimer's disease before you have any symptoms involves deposition of this amyloid protein, and we're looking at who is carrying this protein, even though they're in the earliest stages and are entirely asymptomatic. So ultimately we'll be able to see if are the people who are less busy, associated with, say, carrying amyloid. So we'll learn a whole lot as we move forward.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, thank you both. It was a great hour. Enormous interest. Our phone lines were just flooded. So thank you for participating.
Terrific. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, glad to have you, and let us know of any future work that you're doing or the results of those scans. Our guest this hour, Dr. Denise Park. She's Director of Research at the Center for Vital Longevity, Distinguished University Chair in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, and a research scholar at the University of Texas in Dallas. Sarah Festini, Postdoc Research Associate at the Center as well. Thanks so much to KP Whaley for producing this interesting show, and to KP for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Hour two, we're going to ask you to be our guests and our thinkers as we talk about the difficult time we're having in America when it comes to guns, police, race, and violence. How do we move ahead?